This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series.
We're back.
We're back.
It's the end of the holidays. It's like the last, well, the last holiday, the last work day of the holidays. How are you feeling?
Really tired.
Really tired. It just feels like they should have, is it wrong to say they could have reduced holidays on the basis that
I know, right?
To normal programming.
It is definitely. And we've had, because of the COVID week and the extra week of holidays, this is the end of our fourth week of the kids not being at school. So it does feel like
you really struggled.
We took them out.
You?
Yeah. What a foolish thing to do.
Wow. Oh,
but yes, the post-COVID fatigue has certainly been a thing. But also I have to say that our very best friends in the world have been down from Broome, and we haven't seen them in 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And so there has been also, between the napping, there has been quite a lot of delightful socializing. So I can't complain too much.
Well, the cool bit about these friends that you're talking about is it's your best friend and Adam's best friend, isn't it? So this is like one of those perfect foursomes where everybody's happy.
Everyone's happy. The kids are happy. I love that you brought that up for anyone who doesn't know that, just that, you know, the hilarious ridiculousness of our high school sweethearts-ness. But yes, that it has been quite delightful to all hang out together. And despite the fact that the kids are 2.5 years older and 2.5 years cooler, as they all are, they're still very happy to all hang out together. You went to the beach.
Yeah.
You got some beach time.
We got some serious beach time. We went away with friends as well. It was great. It was really fun. Everybody was happy. Same kind of scenario. The adults were happy. The kids were happy. Yeah.
Do you still ocean swim at this time of year, Catherine Collette?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because my mum ended up coming down for a few days and we went for an ocean swim at Inverloch. But we had to go, because it's got waves, we had to go behind the waves, and both of us were pretty keen to get out, I think. Like, we did sort of the quickest kilometre, I think, of all time.
Excellent.
Both very conscious of, well, I was swimming further out, which I thought she should have been the one that swam further out.
Why?
Just lived a good life. No, not really. I did say that though when we got in.
Oh, that's hilarious.
It was nice to have done. Normally it's also nice to be doing, but this felt more like a nice to have done.
When we last talked, I was so filled with COVID self-pity that I forgot to ask you if you hit your writing goal when you went away to Musk, when I was not there, not writing. Did you hit it?
No, nowhere near.
No,
it was completely unrealistically ambitious.
What, you made ambitious writing goals, Catherine? I don't believe it.
Well, I think the other part, like the unsung part of writing retreats, is also downtime. Like, yeah. Let's be honest, that's also a pretty special part of the process.
Yeah. So do you get writing done?
Downtime goal.
That's good. Do you get writing done during school holidays, or are they just a write-off for you?
They're not a complete write-off. I get some time, but it's early morning time and it's interrupted. I get a lot of visits, a lot of cuddles, a lot of requests for food. The food request. I don't know what the answer is. We just need like one of those, it's terrible, like a dog food button where it just like dribbles out, comes out the bottom. Stop it.
I think so many people over time have given me advice, and these are often women, often who write from home and or who don't work for whatever reason during school holidays or take time off, that it is just better to say, I'm not going to get anything done, and then you don't feel such regret and resentment.
Well, yeah, it's the resistance, isn't it? Like the trying. Yeah, I think I'll try that next time.
Yeah.
That is actually good advice. You have a is it a 5-day or a 7-day Sarah Centilli's
Sarah Centilli's
quotation mark retreat?
Yeah, never done it before. So this is a 7-day word cave. You know, impossible to actually cut out all that time. So I am going to, I've got 3 nights of it away in my gorgeous friend's new holiday house. So I'll have 3 days on my own. And then, you know, various things, including my darling Etta's birthday, mean that I have to come back and be in town. But I am going to try the out of office, you know, making sure that I don't do other things. I've also got a PhD deadline coming up. So some of it will be put towards that kind of writing. But because it's all on a theme, it kind of works for me. And I have certainly got a bit of a head of steam up to work on the novel after the holidays off and the COVID time, etc. So hopefully that works.
The words will flow.
Exactly.
Before we go into our featured book section, just a quick update. The Lismore Flood Auction. Did you see how much they raised?
Oh my goodness me. What was the final figure?
57,000.
That is amazing. Zanny Louise, you are a star for getting that rolling, because as much as people, it's very easy to donate things, but it's much, much harder to be the person who organises it all, I can imagine.
Well, even just having a bank account that would go into, I feel
right.
A complicated proposition. We raised $600, which is awesome.
Really cool.
Having dinner with Joe Dixon and friend. But thank you to everyone that bid. We felt very special.
We did feel special. Do you know who got the high? What was the thing that was the most popular?
It was a tarot reading by Jessica Adams, who then I went looking at. So I think it was more than $3,000.
Whoa!
She's also a writer, but she's like this crazy astrology. I'm not saying that is inherently crazy. I mean, she's crazy good. So she predicted COVID to the day that the first person, like, died in China. I don't know how you verify that. But anyway, I fell down this hole just looking to the point where now I'm like, oh, my God, I need a tarot reading, which I would never do because I'm in that camp of, like, too believing. Like,
I totally do tarot readings. Like,
you do or?
I don't for myself, but, like, when friends do them, I'm totally up for them. Also, remember I did spend a formative 10 years working in the hippie shop with a lot of readings and tarot and astrology and the rest of it. So it's deep in my bones, despite the fact that I am very much oftentimes a very big skeptic, but also quite formative
for me. I
feel like
I need to know more about that. Crystals? Are you into crystals?
There was a lot of crystals in my youth.
I feel like crystals is where I draw the line. Non-believer when it comes to crystals, but I believe in anything else. Anyway, on to our featured book. Carolyn Petit was born in Washington, D.C., raised in Maryland, and now lives in Melbourne with her husband. She is a graduate of the Chatham College in Pittsburgh. That included studying at the London School of Economics and holds advanced degrees from Johns Hopkins University, the University of Melbourne's School of Law, and a graduate diploma in professional and writing and editing from RMIT. That sounds like a very familiar course.
Yes.
Her previous novels, The Fat Man's Daughter and Deep Night, were published in the US by Soho Press, and her newest book, The Natural History of Love, is out with Affirm Press on April 26.
Welcome, Caroline. It's so good to have you with us.
It's delightful to be here.
Can you give us the pitch for this amazing new book, The Natural History of Love, please?
Yes. It's an historical novel based on the lives of real people. It's the story of Carolina Fonseca, a Brazilian, and her lover, the French Count de Castelnau. And the story takes place in Brazil, the salons of Paris, and then Melbourne as in its early settlement from the 1860s.
Oh, fabulous. Carolyn, where did the writing of the book begin?
Well, the writing of the book did not begin for a while, but in about year 2000, there was a country property called Mayfield that was open to the public to have a look around before it was demolished in Mordialloc to make way for a concrete plant.
God.
But what the house was looked at for its architectural significance, which was nil. But the grounds were really very important, but they weren't looked at because the Count was a naturalist, an explorer, and also the French diplomat, and had created this sort of botanical garden. Now, what was left of the year 2000 when he moved in about 1876 is debatable. But along with that came a story of what these people and their sons who lived in the house of their life. And I was really attracted to the fact that everyone talked about the Count de Castelnau. And the Count de Castelnau was an explorer of North America, South America, and other parts of the world, as well as a naturalist and a diplomat. But Carolina, whom he had met when she was 16 in a Brazilian plantation, and he was near death, and she nursed him back to health, they stayed together. They never married because he was already married, which she didn't know about when they were found in bed together. And they stayed together for the rest of their lives. And I thought that that was a wonderful story. And then they had two illegitimate sons, and there was a horrific inheritance case after they both died, which also absorbed me tremendously.
Oh, it's such a fabulous book. There's so much to get into. But first, Carolyn, you have been published previously in the US. Can you tell us about how you got to be published here?
Oh, well, look, I have lived in Australia for 40 years. So I am an Australian citizen, and I consider myself an Australian, really, because I raised my children here. I have my grandchildren here. That's it. I'm not going anywhere.
Excellent.
And so I wanted to write an Australian novel, and I didn't know what I wanted to write. And then this story kept bothering me, and I wanted to find out more. And the University of Melbourne had in their archives all of the files of the early legal firms that were in Melbourne when that first was settled. And I went to the dusty legal files, and there was a lot of dust, and started to read about them. And the story unfolded, and I wrote the story. I gave up working. I decided if I didn't write, I would never do it. My children were a bit older. And so I went to RMIT and I wrote. And then I found it easier to get published in the States for reasons I won't go into. But anyway, I did. And then I had this book and this manuscript, and I was very lucky through a great friend, through a wonderful friend who gave me a recommendation to my literary agent. Now, she wasn't then, and she fell in love with it. But she had a hard time, I think. You know, things have a time and a place. And I think now is a time and a place when Australians are looking both forward and backward in time, and seeing what their colonial history is. And the people that I've chosen to write about aren't the usual pioneering families. They are an upper class family. And what she went through and what he did in terms of his own natural history as an explorer and a scientist and that kind of thing, I found very interesting. I also decided that they would have a great deal of, that would be overtaken, I think, by the ideas of Darwin, which was beginning to be filtered through. And that also sort of forms an intellectual existential debate within them. And the other thing that really interested me was the story about how a mistress is a perilous occupation. So that was another aspect to it.
There's obviously so much research involved in this. You've talked about archival research. You've obviously had that mansion to visit at a certain point as well. How long did the research take, and where did it take you? And how did you decide, I suppose, what to leave out?
Well, it took me there, and I read a lot of books of the times. You know, what I really found was that the diaries of people who had been in English mostly, because were of people visiting in Brazil and that kind of thing, and also Paris in Napoleon III's Second Empire. And then I was lucky enough to have a French friend who I met because we exchanged our houses for international travel in France. And she was the curator for the museums of Marseille, but she hooked me up with the Natural History Museum in Paris so that I could read some of the correspondence that Francois' wife, who was a countess in her own right, wrote to try and get Francois his major expedition that he went to South and Central America, and wrote five volumes about his travels in there in French, which I dipped into, but my French isn't that good. So I took I read small samples.
Oh, that's incredible. Caroline, you've mentioned that Carolina's perspective from the book was a perspective that was really missing from the archives. What was it about her story that you were keen to tell?
I think that we leave women, especially at that time, out of history. I mean, there was this long obituary when Francois died, and he was 20 years, a good 20, more than 20 plus years older than her. He died in 1880. And there was this long obituary about his stellar career and all the things that he had done. There was not a mention of Carolina in there, because not just the fact that they weren't married, I think, but it was the idea that women, ladies, were not to have their names in print. That was the idea of male journalists. So she had no footprint in history, and I wanted to give her a voice.
Carolyn, we have so many writers who listen to this podcast and who are always seeking advice, and particularly I think a number who really are interested in writing historical fiction. What's the best advice that you can give to them, something that maybe you've received or that you've come to understand yourself?
Well, I think especially in historical novels, you get to tell history from the inside, and no one, I mean, a historian can tell you the sweep of history, but as a writer, it doesn't make a good story unless you're inside and you have the emotional aspects of things. And that's what I was looking to know, what these people were really like, and how they had such secrets and lies that held them together, but also had terrible consequences for their sons. And I think that's where you have to tell the story from today's perspective. I think that's really important. But you have to be able to make it so that it does include the facts, some of the facts, not all of the facts, but some facts of the times and what it was like to live there. But you give your characters an interior life.
You balance that interior life so well, to Caroline, with the use of devices like translators and things that sort of pepper more factual stuff throughout the book. We are on to the final question, which is about debut books. Do you have a recommendation of a novel, nonfiction, anything from any time, any genre?
This is not an Australian book, but it's a book that the imagination of the writer swept me away. It's called The Mermaid of Black Conch, Conch, C-O-N-H.
And the author of that is?
Monique Ruffey.
Excellent. Caroline, do you have any events coming up to celebrate the launch of The Natural History of Love that we can let our listeners know where you'll be?
Yes, the launch of the book itself will take place on the 28th of April at the readings at the State Library. And the State Library was chosen because Francois, the Count, not only left his books to the State Library, but it used to be the old Melbourne Museum, and his Beetle collection and some other artifacts of his life are there.
Excellent. We'll put a link into that. Caroline, it's so lovely to have been able to talk to you. Thank you so much for giving us a little bit of history behind your new book, The Natural History of Love, which I'm only this far in, but I'm loving it so far. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to talk about articles of interest. Go first.
I'm loving this new section. Article? It's making me feel very kind of academic during the week. I do.
Topical.
I read, you know how I am into writers' journals. It was kind of a big
Oh.
feature of the PhD, and I'm generally into them anyway. And there was an article in the New Yorker this week from Lauren Michelle Jackson, and it's on the new release of Alice Walker's journals, which have just been released. The collection's called Gathering Blossoms Under Fire. But this article is wonderful, and it talks about how Alice Walker kept journals. I think it's like 1965 to 2000, this collection. So it's not like as in depth as Helen Garner's. It's not had to, be spread out over all of these kind of different publications. But she does kind of lists in there, thinking all the kind
Oh.
of general the general kind of stress about writing and life and being, at one stage then she's a single, black woman looking after raising her kids, trying to write. So she has stuff about money, lists of like what she's earning, what she needs to earn. It's really, it looks like it's going to be a really interesting collection. One of the things Lauren Michelle writes, the pages of the journal leave a record of both the pulsing epiphanies and the irritations of daily existence and chart for a dimly perceived intimate reader the progress of a literary pilgrim. Pain, joy, spells of depression, unease, engagement, even disaffection, all are material. They'll feed the writings and sustain the readings. So I'm just, it was the kind of article that meant I was getting little bits of Alice Walker in there, but I also immediately went to look at where I could buy this thing. So yeah, Gathering Blossoms Under Fire. I'll put a link in there. I think Hachette is publishing them in Australia. So one for my list. What about you? What have you been
Such
reading?
interesting stuff, just the form that people's diaries take, like what you include.
Exactly.
I love the
Exactly.
lists.
I know.
Do you subscribe to Literary Hub?
I don't
LitHub.
subscribe, but I do go in
Ah,
often and see good
they're
articles.
good, a really good daily newsletter. Way
Oh,
too many articles to ever keep up with,
damn
but
it.
a lot of gels. And also quite, I guess, US centric,
Yep.
not Australian centric. They did one cute read recently that was Ann Patchett, who wrote The Dutch House, among other things. Her longtime publicist, Jane Berin, was retiring. So she wrote this sort of
Oh.
aid ode to her publicist. It was really, really lovely.
Oh, that is
But it was
so
just that
nice.
moment of reflecting on writers get limelight, editors get a bit of limelight, and publishers get a bit of limelight. But publicists, like a good publicist, is an incredible thing.
Did you send it on to
So
Jane?
that was, well, I should send it
You
on to
should
Jane.
send it
Jane
to
has
Jane.
just left text as well. So maybe it kind of hit me at that moment.
Yeah, wow.
She talks about a publicist meets the world on your behalf. But there was also a good quote, the only thing worse than a book tour is no book tour, which I love.
That is really nice. And that was one of the things I think we talked about this being back at Adelaide, that the people who were even maybe more excited than the authors were the publicists in the green room. Like they were so, it was like we're getting a chance to do our job properly, and you can
Yes,
see
pretty tough.
how
Well, I
hard they were.
remember Jane, when we interviewed her for this podcast, was saying, particularly in that first initial stages of COVID, how could you even pitch a book? Like, what airspace would there possibly be when literally whole cities are tuning into premiers' press conferences? Like,
But they did
there's just
so
no
well, and
space.
they
Yeah, they
still
did.
did. Like from this side that we see it as part of the podcast, they still came up with very inventive
Yeah.
ways of getting our attention. I was really impressed.
It is cool seeing the other side, isn't it? Like you really,
Yeah,
yeah.
we're super lucky. This position of privilege that we have here on the podcast, Catherine.
It is.
Talking podcasts, have you been listening to any? You always have such good recommendations.
I have The Writer's Room, and not the Charlotte Wood one, which is
There's
also
another
good,
one.
but there is another one, and it's attached to the Sex and the City remake, and just like that. I feel like I've heard lots of people talking about this, but I hadn't tuned in. Have you heard? No. I didn't watch all of the remake. This is a behind the scenes. There's basically one podcast episode for every episode of the series. it's like a creative sort of breakdown of why they made decisions and the things that they thought about.
Oh my gosh.
Michael Patrick King is the sort of writer director. And then they must have a massive team of writers because they get different people in each week. It's so good because it feels like I can never get enough of this behind the scenes stuff, but it feels like, you know how you're in your own head thinking about the pros and cons. So it's just that discussion come alive around, oh, we debated this choice and so-and-so thought this and so-and-so thought that, which is so fascinating. But I think sadly also shows that even when you meticulously think about it, you debate it, you have wonderful writers in the room, you can still get it really wrong.
You can still get it wrong.
Like, it's not for lack of trying, which is sort of humbling, I think, in some respects. Like, when people get it wrong, it's there's a lot of effort that goes in.
Do you think
that, that sits behind that?
I would so love to write a novel with a writer's room. You know, I'm quite the extrovert.
Yeah.
the collaborator. I would just love to see even collaboration, even listening to people who've done it collaboratively. Zana Freilon and Bren McDibble have got a middle grade fiction book coming out together that they met on Twitter and then wrote collaboratively. That's coming out later this year, which will be really exciting to see. And when Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff have talked about it as well, just one person would be cool.
Totally fascinating. The interesting counter to that, though, aside from the fact that Michael Patrick King is constantly being moved by his own work.
Oh no, no.
He's a smidge too celebratory of his own stuff. But you do come away from the podcast going, oh, it's amazing. Like, it sort of bolsters the effect of the show itself.
That is a recommendation that our friend Shay will very much enjoy, because she didn't want to like and just like that and then ended up liking it. Though, Shay, you can correct us on that.
It's also, they made so many choices that were to redress sort of the issues that existed within the first
That's interesting.
Within the first series, and you see them sort of unpack that. And if you are at all familiar with it, you do have a sense of what worked and what was too much, like what kind of narrative threads, and I think this applies to writing in general, are done to serve the narrative and what things are done to serve, you know, to make a statement
a bigger
or a commentary.
Context, social.
Exactly. There is also this element of it that feels like it's anticipating critique, you know, like it's on the front foot.
Isn't that how we're, to some extent, that's what we're, I feel like there is a threat of that at the moment when we're writing. If you're engaged in the kind of bigger lit discussions or you're on Twitter and things like that, there is a part of you that is always anticipating there's a part of you that's always anticipating criticism anyway, but anticipating certain types of critique as well, which is maybe a good thing.
Well, maybe we should make podcasts about our books to explain and justify. Anyway, I think it's really interesting. And then the other one that's good is that Sentimental Garbage that I've mentioned before. They had done a very, very well listened to commentary of Sex and the City. They've now gone back and done it just like that. And they have also listened to this Writer's Room podcast. And so that's an interesting commentary that kind of at times blends the two.
Oh, my God, there's just commentary on commentary on commentary on commentary. What is this world that we have become? Very meta.
What have you been listening to?
I haven't been listening to anything except for some preparation for some of the interviews coming up, which is what I've been reading. So I'll just go straight into that. Michelle Decretz's Scary Monsters, which is, I'm sure you've seen, and is got two covers. So it's a flip book. Very, very cool, very interesting form and structure. I'm so looking forward to speaking with Michelle. But, you know, what I've found that I really do love so much about doing these interviews is that then I just use my you know, podcast app as a search function, and I just listen to a bunch of different interviews with the people that we're about to interview, and I love it. I love getting those little sound grabs and learning different things and also different interview techniques. Yeah, it's one of my favorite things. Do you do that?
Well, I hadn't ever understood that that exists, that you could search for someone who you want to listen to talk.
Yeah.
It was you that mentioned it, and now yeah. I do it. I even just even Google the person's name and podcasts and
yeah, have, and see what comes
like
up.
There's like a collation websites and stuff that.
Yeah. Will,
but it's interesting. I think what's funny about that is that sometimes you will have avenues you really are keen to go down. And if you've heard them talk about those things in a couple of interviews, you assume they will take you down that avenue. And then
yeah.
you can just not go down it. And,
yeah.
And yeah.
The other nice thing I think about it is that increasingly now, if a story is told really well in another podcast or another interview, I'm just as happy now to leave it and pop that interview in the show notes, because I know now the way that I kind of fall down the rabbit hole when I'm finishing a book, which I often do, I finish a book if I love it. So one of the ones that I've also just read is Jennifer Egan's new one, The Candy House, which I adored. And so then I immediately go into reviews, looking at reviews or looking at some of the commentary or longer essays and articles, and then into interviews with the person about the book as well. So weird. Maybe
that's
I shouldn't
a lot,
do that.
Because I reckon if I've listened, I guess it depends on the person and the book, but often I won't listen to another interview unless I'm researching someone.
Yeah.
Because there often is a lot of crossover. Like if I yeah. saw that one person had interviewed another. But maybe that's more when a book has just come out.
Yeah. And look, these books, Egan's is certainly one, you know, I was so looking forward to it.
Is it more like Goon Squad? Than...
It is. It's a yeah. sequel.
Oh, I didn't
so
realize
it takes,
that.
Oh my gosh, it's so crazy. We need to talk about this at a longer point for a longer thing, but it takes a peripheral character from Goon Squad and some of the other characters and then does the same kind of thing Goon Squad does, which is like moves around in that very kind of interlinked but loose way, but it's not loose. It's so smartly, cleverly done. I really think that you'll enjoy it very much.
So
it's
good.
So brilliantly done. And someone actually contacted me on Instagram when I said I was reading it, and they said, oh, I haven't read this. You know, do you recommend it? And I hadn't finished it yet, but I said, you know, it stands alone, but you really do get a much bigger thrill if you've read Goon Squad as well, because it just... Well,
Goon Squad's so good anyway.
And Goon Squad's so good anyway, but it just has like different light bulbs going off in your head. I'm also reading halfway through, but saving it until I am on my writer's retreat, Lee Kaufman's new book on writing, The Writer Laid Bare, which is so good. And I know because... you've interviewed Lee for the podcast.
She is someone I would listen to multiple interviews.
Oh my gosh. She is so smart and wise, but also in the book, like her craft in crafting not only sentences but ideas into paragraphs and everything. It's like, you know, there's multiple lessons going on while you're reading the book. So I've stopped at the end of part one and made myself wait and put it in a pile of books to take away with me, because that's the kind of thing I like doing when I'm on retreat. What have you been reading, Catherine Collette?
I did Meet the Schnabels.
Oh, did you love it?
It's good. Yeah, really, yeah. Really good. So that's Toni Jordan's latest book, her first book with Hachette.
Yes.
From Text. It's really good. I think you talked about it last time, but it follows a sort of a guy who feels a bit down and out and has to landscape a garden
for
a family member.
And the narrative tension of landscaping a garden.
Made me think of, I was listening to a podcast on that LitHub website. They have a podcast and they have an interview with Maeve Higgins, who co-hosts The Mother of Invention.
Huh.
The ex-Irish president, a podcast I always mean to listen to, but I've never listened to. It's about women doing stuff for climate change. Not even the podcast I'm talking about. Anyway, the Mother of Invention is meant to be amazing. It's like widely renowned in terms of climate change podcasts.
Adding to
anyway,
list.
Maeve Higgins, in a different podcast, was talking about the relationship between levity and seriousness and how she thinks that you need both.
Huh.
And you need the two of them in life, but you also need them in writing. And in reading Meet the Schnabels, you can totally see this constant like push-pull between funny and then serious and then funny and serious.
Oops. Which is really something good. I might say, Catherine Collette, just off the cuff, you do very well in your books, particularly in the competition.
She also, actually, just talking on this Maeve Higgins because it's in my head, talks about the power of language, which we know about the power of language, but gives a couple of specific examples, one being Trump in all of his talking about illegal immigration uses the term aliens, which is so dehumanizing. And another one was under George Bush, we had the people use the term global warming, but they decided that that was too threatening. So that's why we say climate change. It was a policy decision. Which I think is really interesting.
And, you know, maybe next time we catch up, we will move on to the politics of language in this crazy 6 weeks of election. I don't know whether it's a laugh or cry. Anyway, we'll hold that. That can be.
Anyway, Meet the Schnabels is a great escapist read.
Excellent.
On that note, I don't think we have any events coming up this month because the month is nearly over.
The month is nearly over. We don't have any events. Next month we'll be in other places. We'll be in Bendigo. And we're going... Are we writing retreat again? We're going back to Musk?
I'll be in Queenscliff that weekend.
Actually, oh, you're in Queenscliff?
Come with me and we're going to have a night away together, which will be really
fun. Now, with Queenscliff... Okay, here's a question then for Carney and for you. For the Queenscliff Writers Festival, given that it's over 3 weekends, are there like artist drinks kind of situations? And if there are, will Carney be attending with you as your plus one?
I have not been informed about any artist drinks. So I think that they probably happened on the first weekend.
Uh-huh.
And those people maybe are going. But my event, which is with Jackie Byron and Tony Jordan, is on the Sunday afternoon. Excellent. Of the last day, which I feel like is, I don't know if you hang around.
Oh, they'll hang around like for you.
In terms of end of session drinks.
Okay.
You
don't really, yeah, that's true. That's true. Not really a thing. Well, maybe we'll get Carney on to do a little, never had the blokes on the podcast, have we? Maybe we'll get Carney on to do a little moment about how he feels as being the plus one. Adam's never come. I have invited him, and to an upcoming festival, I am taking my sister as my date. Because she will enjoy the writer's drinks, but Adam, not so much.
Well, so much. I think Carney would quite enjoy himself.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.